Okay, so this topic, I'm not sure. I've never seen a presentation on it, never really heard anyone speak about it, but it just hit me a couple of months ago. Like, wow, I wonder how that. I guess it must have been when we were learning Yevamos, because this is all about the last couple chapters of Yevamos is kind of the basis for the halachic aspects of the issues we'll be discussing tonight. And maybe over the course of learning that section in Daf Yomi, I was wondering, how did they practically resolve this at the end of World War II? At the end of, you know, at the end of the Holocaust, so there were thousands upon thousands of these people. I went through some of the numbers today as to the exact percentages were. We'll get to them shortly. But just how did it work? How did all these people eventually resolve their lives and moving on? You don't hear about this class of people that were just ruled the gunos forever and ever following following the Holocaust. So how did that happen? Both halachically as well as practically. I mean, you could learn the sugyas about how conceivably it would work, but just practically, how did it work? So what is the basis of what we're talking about? Resolving the Aguna crisis from the Holocaust. So the basis is found in the towards the end of Maseches Yevamos. There is a Mishnah. It kind of discusses it for about a daf. Then you kind of leave this issue for about 15 dafim. And then the last couple of pages of Maseches Yevamos get into, in detail, what are the things that we're looking for when a man possibly has passed away. Meaning a woman passes away, so technically, although this was an issue following the Holocaust, there are tshuvos about it, as we'll see, but a man in theory can have multiple wives. So if we're not sure if a woman died or not, so okay. I mean, there's a way around it. There's something called the Heter Mei Rabbanim that you need to sign. You need to get 100 rabbis to sign. There's actually, I think, signed two in my career. But that's we're not talking on as high a level as we are in the opposite scenario, and that is when a man has disappeared and we don't know whether he is alive, because we'll see what happens in the following Mishnah. So the first couple of lines of the first Mishnah in, I think, the 10th parak of Yevamos says, "Ha'isha shehalach b'ayla l'medina sayam." So the man has gone overseas. "Ubo v'amru la meis balecha v'nises." Right? And come along someone. Now, truth, I should have included this Rashi. But Rashi said explicitly, we're talking about one aid. So one aid shows up, one witness. Generally in halacha we require two witnesses, right? One witness shows up. That one witness doesn't even necessarily have to be a man above the age of 13, right? It could be, we will accept other women, for instance. Other people that are generally pasul edus, they will be accepted. And she gets married based on that testimony. Va'achar kach ba baila. Then her husband shows up. Right, so what happens in that scenario? So teitzi mizeh umizeh, she has to be divorced from both of them. Tzricha get mizeh umizeh, she has to get a get from both of them. Vein lo ksuva, velo peros, velo mazonos, velo blos. She doesn't get any of the financial rewards that come from, well, not really rewards, but financial restitution that comes from losing out on her marriage. And it concludes by saying, any child that was born from either one is going to be considered a mamzer. Now, from either one, meaning let's say she goes back to her original husband, right, after marrying another person, so she has a child from that man, so we're going to consider that child a mamzer. Now, Rashi, so you learn this Mishnah and you just think that it doesn't really work, al pi halacha. I mean, why should that be? That a child is going to be, from the first, right? A woman is, I understand that she's not allowed to stay with the second husband. I understand that if she marries the second husband, the child is going to be a mamzer from that marriage. I get that. But if she goes back to her first husband, so I understand maybe it's prohibited, even though it's probably not prohibited on a Doraisa level. But why, child shouldn't be a mamzer. Right? And Rashi is bothered by all of these things, that why should she even have to leave the first husband? That doesn't, and why do you need a get from the second husband? Technically, she's never married to the second husband, so why does she need a get from the second husband? So Rashi explains, the Rashi I put on the page, Tesei Mizomi Zek Kishar Isha Sish Zinsa, right? Like other wives who get involved in immoral activities, the Hachlev Andusahi, that she wasn't really forced. Okay. One can make a case that she was a shogi, whatever, but she wasn't forced. So Rashi spells out the rule here. Even though the Rabbanan will believe one witness when it comes to a woman, when it comes to this case, meaning I'm not sure whether the husband is still alive or not, will accept testimony from one witness, mishumi guna, right? Because it's a case of an aguna, and therefore one will attempt to be lenient. Time am I? Why does it work? I mean, it's very nice that we want to be lenient and allow one witness, but the Torah should demand, and technically should be demanding, two witnesses. So why do we only require one witness? So mishum dehi gufa daika adi yada bekushtu minzaba bahadalo daika kansila. Because we assume that before a woman goes ahead and relies on this one witness, she's going to do her own bedikos, she's going to do her own investigation. And one can go two ways on this. Either, because she did her own investigation, therefore, and she was supposed to, and she obviously didn't do it, so therefore we're going to put a knas upon her, or to motivate her to make sure that she does a proper investigation, we're going to impose these penalties, which are way beyond what otherwise should have been. I mean, we tell her, you're allowed to get married now, but realize that if you're wrong about this, right? So then there's going to be significant repercussions going forward. So that is the... that's okay, don't worry. That is the premise of this entire sugya. So the skip 25 dafim. Now we're on the very end of Maseches Yevamos. And it tells the story of, just go to the underlined part. I'm a Rabbi Yossi. Maisa besuma shiyar, we can't really go there. Let's do the first line of the Mishnah. Nafal amayim, a person falls into the water. And that's kind of the classic cases here. Man's on a ship, he falls into the water, and we don't know what happened to him. So bein sheyesh lahen sof, bein she'ein lahen sof. Right, whether there is a end to the water, meaning whether you could see it's a lake and you could see all the borders of the water, or whether you can't see where the water ends. So ishto asuro, his wife is going to be prohibited, plus we don't know what happened to the guy. I'm Rabbi Meir, Maisa be'echad shenafal bor hagadol v'ol achad shel shenu. Once happened, a guy fell into a pit and it came up after 3 days. Once happened. How did he survive? We don't know. But somehow, that's Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir, throughout Shas, is what we call choshesh lamit. He's always concerned for the far-fetched opinion. Right, so the Rabbi Meir would say it would go according to that opinion. However, Amar Rabbi Yosi, Maisa Besuma, once happens a blind person, Shiyarad Litful Bamara, Viyarad Moshko Acharav, that he once went into a cave and his leader went in after him, and he was stuck there. He was lost in the cave, must have been a water cave, I assume they're talking about. We don't know what happened to him, and they allowed his wife to get remarried. And also another guy fell into the ocean. They only found his leg later. The Chachamim say that if they found his leg and it was cut off from the knee and above, so then he could get remarried, because we assume that there's no way he would have survived having his leg from the thigh down cut off. But if it was from the knee and downwards, then we're not going to allow him to get remarried. Okay, so what is going on here in this Mishnah, right? What are they talking about, right? They're trying to say, well, is there a possibility that the guy is still alive, right? And they make the biggest distinction that they have here is between what we call a Maim She'ish Lehem Sof and a Maim She'ein Lehem Sof. Water that hasn't border, that is surrounded by borders, in which case we could look around and see that he didn't get up anywhere. We've been here a day. He didn't come up anywhere. I could see the entire border, right? There's no way he survived. Right? So therefore we're going to be makel. There's a chance, there's something, maybe he was eaten by a fish, the Gemara suggests, right? Oh, that's crazy, that's not going to happen, that's the Rabbi Meir Shita. But we don't pask in that way. Right? We pask in that as long as you can look around and see they didn't get up, that's okay. But if it's a Maim She'ein Lahem Sof, it's in the middle of the sea, so then we don't know what happened to them. Right, maybe he's alive, maybe he's not alive, so therefore we're going to have to be strict. Now, I wanted to find a list of a time when we're actually machmer on this. Are we ever actually machmer? So you're not going to find really any responsa saying that, we have to be machmer, because no one wants to write that, right? We'd rather let the guy look around and find a rav who's willing, maybe could come up with an idea for how, or the girl, to be lenient. But I came across, we've quoted this fellow a few times, Rav Betzal Ilouay. He was a rav in America in the middle of the 1800s. We quoted him this morning at First Seder. He was a contemporary of the Binyan Sion, however. He was from that, he was a friend of the Binyan Sion. So he was a rav in New Orleans, as well as St. Louis and Baltimore and some other places in America as well. And there's a book called Milchamos Elukim about some of the things that he went through when he was in America, and it tells the file, and it has a list of psakim in this book. We quoted him before. He's the one who was Matir the Caribbean Esrogan, right? He was also the one who is another tshuva about a woman taking a trolley to shul, even though it was a horse-drawn carriage. Right? It's a Interesting. So he has this one line here. He writes, he would not permit the child of a man who was lost at sea on the steamer Morning Star that was wrecked between New York and New Orleans and who was last seen throwing a sofa into the sea and about to jump in after it to say Kaddish. Right? There's a guy who was on some boat from New York, from New Orleans to New York, and the boat sinks. Right? And he's last seen by survivors. Right? Nobody knows what happened to him, but he's last seen throwing in so I assume it means like a mattress that he's hopefully going to survive on. Right? So we last see him alive. We don't know what happened to him. It's what we call a mind chain lenosov. Who knows where he went? Right? So they didn't allow his child to say Kaddish. But in those situations when there was an iguna involved, we don't allow anybody to do avelis, because we're concerned if they do avelis, then the woman's going to then go off and get remarried. Right? So the lach is we don't allow them to do avelis. So he wouldn't allow the child to say Kaddish. Right? This for the reason that it would have evidenced that the wife was positively a widow and would remarry at her pleasure, whilst he held that according to Jewish law, she was not such. Right? So there are such people. There's a neighbor on my block who told me that her grandmother was an aguna in Europe. Like, wow, like what happened? Well, her husband went away on a business trip to America, boat sank, never heard from again, and they didn't allow her to get remarried. That was it. There was no heter for her to get remarried. So these issues sometimes are not resolved. Okay, now, one more premise in terms of from the Gemara generation, and then we'll skip about 18 centuries, or actually, no, 15 centuries or so. So there's one more, on that mission in Yevamos, there's a Gemara makes a comment. Amar of Ashi, had Amar Rabbanan, Maim She'en Lehem Sof Ishto Asura, right, is source number four, right? A water that has no end, the wife is prohibited, because we don't know what happened to it, him, Hani Mili Be'inish De'alma. That's by a regular guy. About surber mirabanan lo, right? But a surber mirabanan, meaning a rabbinic scholar, idasalik kal isle. If he would survive, if he would appear in some town down the river, right? So they'd say, oh, Ashrei Shabalakan, this great Talmud Chacham, right? He would and he would be recognized as stuff, and there would be a cult, we would hear about it. And then it says velohi, not necessarily loshni ish de'amo loshni tzumir abanan dievet in lechachil lo. But then it says, well, we don't really paskin that way, whether a regular person or tzumir abanan, but dievet will allow them to stay married. But lechachila, that's not we're not going to rely on the lack of on the lack of a sound. The Gemara actually goes on and tells the famous story about Rabbi Akiva. That Rabbi Akiva was held on to the daf of, they tell us always by the Siyum HaShas, that he held on to the daf in order to stay alive through the river. Well, not for now. Okay, so I think Pesach Kron gave that at a, I don't know, Yisachar Fran, that one of the Siyum HaShas has quoted that Gemara.
So the Gemara back on number two says, Nafal L'mayim Ben
Sheyesh. Right, so we don't paskin like that. That's Rabbi Meir's Shita,
oh,
okay. And we paskin like Rabbi Yossi.
Oh.
That we make a distinction between Mayim Sheyesh Lemsof and Mayim Shein Lemsof. Okay, so now we're going to the 1800s, still pre-Holocaust, but much of the, perhaps the thesis for things that would come up later appeared then. Now, realize this is the 1800s is already the Industrial Revolution. Things were changing. People were moving around a lot more frequently, perhaps not as safely, and people were going all over the world. And there were, the world was changing, and the great posik of that generation was Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. Right, I personally went to Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. Right, the Yeshivas Yitzchak Elchanan was named after him after he had passed away. The one of the yeshivas in Slobodka was named after him. He was the posek hador of the 19th century. He was the Rav of Kovna. Okay, so the Rav Yitzchak Elchanan. In fact, there's a story told in The Making of a Gadol that there was a bigger yeshiva in Europe that wanted to name themselves after him. And then someone told them, no, this hole in the wall in America, just name them Rav Yitzchak Elchanan, so the name's taken already, you shouldn't use it. Right? And, and they said, the hole in the wall in America, please, what's ever going to be with that? And, that became a pretty prestigious institution. So Rav Yitzchak Elchanan has, I'm not sure why he has two sets of tshuvos, one called the Be'er Yitzchak and one called the Ayin Yitzchak, but he became famous for answering these types of aguna shilos, mainly because he was willing to rely on a specific chiddush that he came up with, right? So Rav Yitzchak Elchanan was asked, This actually comes up in a tshuva. The case was a man was seen flowing down the river. What do we call, what does it mean flowing down the river? When you hear a river, you hear, right, in our halachic terms, a mayim she'ein lehem sof. Right? So how could you be makel on a mayim she'ein lehem sof? So however, part of the case was that as he's floating down, a tree comes, he was wrapped up in a storm, a tree comes off the bank and slams him in the head. Right? Slams him in the head, and then he's never heard from again. Right? That's the case that Rizal Khan was dealing with. Hmm?
There are witnesses to that?
There are witnesses that saw him floating down the river and then get hit in the head. Nobody, there's no witnesses that saw him dead. Right? They just saw that scenario. So Rav Yitzchak Elchanan in this tshuva, yeah, I want to make sure that we have time for the second page, so I'll just say it outside. Rav Yitzchak Elchanan in this tshuva comes up with the following idea. He says, is it a rule? Is that just the rule that a mayim she'ein lehem sof, that a mayim she'ein lehem sof, we won't be lenient? Right? Is that a rule, or is that kind of a premise for something? Is that not really a premise? Is that just a demonstration of something? Is that is that just the takana, right? That the rabbis made mayim she'ein lehem sof, you can't be lenient, or were they? Was it really something else? Was the rule, and this is just the demonstration of the rule? And he says, well, if you go later on in that Gemara about this tsur b'mirabanan, right, this rabbinical scholar that we're not really making on, he says, why was it that the Gemara was even willing to entertain that possibility? Right? Why should that be? Right, just because he's a rabbi, therefore we're going to give him a big kula? Right? Why was that even willing to be a possibility? So Yisrael Khanan says, it's not about the rule of a mayim she'ein lehem sof, rather it's the idea of a rof. It's the idea that you need a majority. Now, the majority of people that are on a boat that sink in sea, that sink in the middle of a sea and we never hear from again, the majority of them die, right? That is the majority. So really, that should be enough to rely on. But Yisrael Chan says, no, that's not enough to rely on. That's the rule by Aguna. The leniency might be we'll rely on one witness, but the stringency is you better have some darn good evidence, right? Just simple rove, just the simple 90%, that's not enough. But Rav Yisrael Chan says, if you could put together what we call shnei ruvei, if you could take two rows, two factors, put them together, that should be sufficient to be matir this person. So he says, I'll give you two rows in this case. A, he's floating down the river and was never heard from again. Right? The majority of people that float down rivers and are never heard from again turn up dead. Right? That's number one. And the second row is, the majority of people that in the middle of a river, in the middle of a storm, get hit in the head by a falling tree, also die, right? So you put the two of those together, right? I'm willing to be makel. I think that case is actually a case of yibum. It was I'm not sure that case was a specific aguna case, but it's the same principle, right? That I'll be willing to be makel and allow his wife to get remarried because not just because he was seen floating down a river and was never heard from again, but because he had the two factors that are put together, right?
So really, you're leveraging the two factors. As well as the fact that there was only one witness, but there might have been two witnesses.
The amount of witnesses isn't relevant because they never actually saw him dead.
Okay, right? But the factors were such that
they established the facts as we established them. Okay. And how do you analyze those facts? Right. Now I will just, you know, I should have said this as an introduction, right? This tshuva from Yitzchak Elchanan, I gave you four lines from it. It is something like 25 pages long. Okay, this is section 20, I think, or 18. I think this is pretty far along. This area of halacha agunos, which we're giving you a taste of tonight, is probably the most written about section of halacha anywhere. Okay, Simin Yud Zayin in Evan Ezra, the section of Shulchan Aruch, probably has the most pages of any simin in all of Shulchan Aruch. And not just because the Shulchan Aruch is that long, but because the Sefer Pisrei Tshuva, which quotes all the responses at the bottom, is that long. The Sefer Otzer HaPoskim, which is an encyclopedia of giving you summaries of many of all posts that have written on it, Simin Yud Zayin gets its own volume. Right? Gets its own volume. It is traditional that the tshuvos are extremely long because you try to prove as much as you can. Right? Now, why is it that it's so complicated? It's so complicated because by definition, you're paskening on a suffix. Right? That's the case, right? It's not that we know anything. Generally, we have to ascertain the facts. I mean, how does electricity work? Like, I figure out electricity works and then plug it into the relevant halachas. Right? Here, we don't actually have the facts. And that's what we're paskening on, a lack of information rather than you know, knowing that rather than the information itself, right? So that's part of what is so complicated. In the second tshuva, he mentions this in this tshuva as well, but he mentions it explicitly in the second case. In the second case was, I can give you the case, I actually have that here, and again, this is part of a larger tshuva. You see, this is Anaf Dalid section Chaf, right? Meaning section 4, subsection 20, right? So this is massive, massive amounts of ink that are being used on this stuff. So v'chein nishalti mikarov mi something London, from the city of London. I got a relative from London. Shnei agunos, al divrei shnei agunos, shebaleihem nisu mi London la'Africa. B'kayitz tafrish memalef, right? So they get on a boat and they go to Africa, right? In the summer of tafrish memalef, this is what, 140 years ago or so. Ba'achar zeh noda lehen ki hasfina shehayu sham ba'aleihem shel agunos hanisker l'el nitba hasfina v'shayu aleihem shir shin taf. I'm not sure what that is. I'm not sure what that stands for. I'm not sure what that is either. But he. But what's he saying? What the Rosh Yitevo stands for? But what's the case? The case is a boat sinks. Right. Nobody sees anything. Right. They just get a telegram from the boat company that, you know, your husbands were on this boat and the boat is no more. Right. That's the information that we have. So Rav Yitzchak Elchanan now goes to a bigger leniency. He says, well, first of all, the majority of people in that scenario die, right? Even though it's what we call a Maim She'ein Lahem Sof, right? They die. By the way, there's a whole issue about accepting non-Jewish testimony, right? That's another several pages of responsa. But then he adds in, and he says, the idea earlier, that Gemara, about the Talmud Chacham who was found, and maybe that's more of a reason to, right? He says, all of that is based on the time of Ravashi. That's Ravashi's time period. He says, but however, you can see the underlined part, Hudach Sam Sofer, B'simen Nun Ches, B'sif Samachai, Kasav, D'yish Lidon Da'ata Nishtana Hazman, that nowadays times are different, B'zman Shai, B'zman Hashas. B'zman Hazek, V'i Beidoar, B'chol HaMedinos, V'telegrafin. Because nowadays we have something called a post office, right, that exists throughout the world, and we have something called telegraphs. He says, and if this guy showed up anywhere in the world, right, there would be a letter that would be sent to his wife saying, don't worry, I'm alive, right, I'm alive, or a telegraph would show up. So he says that in the time of the Gemara, it's not so sure that communication would have ever gotten there. But as man as that, when we have better lines of communication, and therefore one has the right to rely on that. Right? So that is all of a sudden a huge leniency, which then brings us now into the 20th century. But before we get into specific Holocaust cases, I would just, you know, let's actually go now. I took a little look today because, I am technically the grandchild of four survivors. I'm the grandchild of two survivors that were in camps. One was in Auschwitz and one was in Majdanek. The one that my grandmother was in Majdanek actually escaped Majdanek. But I wanted to just see what are the numbers that we're dealing with, because the only people that I've ever met that were in camps are survivors, right? If they didn't survive, they're not out. So I'm used to, like, yeah, so people were there, so some survived, and some people died. Here are the numbers. In Auschwitz, and again, these are disputed, and this is what I figured out from Wikipedia, but just to get a basic amount. 1.1 million dead in Auschwitz. November 1944, when they knew that the Russians were coming, they evacuated 58,000 people. 20,000 of them made it to Bergen-Belsen. That was the famous death march. Right, 20,000 made it to Bergen-Belsen. 7,500 were left behind in the camp to be discovered by Russian troops when they got there. Okay, so of 1.1 now not all of those were Jews, but just to use rough figures, of a million Jews that went there, 20,000 survived. Right, what percentage is that?
2.2.
Right. 2%. Right? So that is a miut, right? That is what we call a very small possibility that they are going to survive. Here are some other camps. Majdanek, 78,000. It's again, very disputed, but anywhere from 78,000 to 235,000 dead. 1,000 were marched to Auschwitz. There were thousands of POWs that were left behind, but those weren't generally Jewish. So I think thousands of POWs were left behind. Okay, so those... So there were some, a couple of, it wasn't as big of a camp. You can still see most of it today. It's right outside Lublin. So Again, a little bit more than that, probably 3-4% survived. Numbers are a little bit smaller. Treblinka was a death camp, as we'll see shortly. If you were in, most of Warsaw ended up being sent to Treblinka. If you were in the Warsaw ghetto, right, Treblinka was probably going to be your destination. 700 to 900,000 killed. There were a few that were kept to work. Now, keep in mind a few other things, right? That's how many perhaps got to the camp. There are stories, of course, of people jumping off trains, right? There are these types of things going on. So does that get factored in as well? I mean, the question is, right, I know that this guy got put on a train to Treblinka, right? That's all I know. I know that, or I have a witness that saw that guy being put on a train to Treblinka, right? Or I saw that person being in the Warsaw Ghetto, and the Warsaw Ghetto was liquidated. So what are the chances, right? Is that going to be considered enough evidence? Buchenwald also a famous camp, smaller than I thought, 56,000 dead, 21,000 were liberated. So that all of a sudden the percentages are a little bit higher, right? One quarter, 25% chance of surviving. Now, I would add that these numbers are skewed because in Auschwitz, 1 million is the amount that we threw out, but it depends where you came from and when you got there, right? If you were from northern Europe, northern Poland, northern Lithuania, and you were sent to Auschwitz, which wasn't so often, but that was earlier in the war, you had a very small chance of surviving. If you were Polish, right, that means you must have spent 3 years there or so, right? It meant you had a little bit more, but not much of a chance of surviving. If you were Hungarian or Romanian, right, so then you were probably there for a year. You had a bit more of a chance of surviving. Right, so that is adding into the factors. Now, I should have maybe perhaps prefaced this with, these are trying to analyzing this as a halacha shir from a distance. Right, I just want to show that out. Obviously, each person is important, but this is what poskim we're dealing with. So, Rav Moshe Feinberg,
if they were trying to utilize the probability of survival.
Well, they're dealing with anything. I mean, they're dealing with all the facts, right?
Sure. And the facts.
What are the fact is? Yes, I know he was in Auschwitz, and I heard a rumor that he was sent on that he was sent out to some killing field or something. We don't know. But what are you add up all of the survivors? We're talking 100,000-200,000 people that are kind of 300. I didn't add up that number, but you're talking a few 100,000 Jews that are in Europe, not knowing where any of their family members are, right? And how are we going to pass into those shilas, right? Now, halachically as well as technically. Now, we'll just go to America for a moment, and then we'll head back into Europe. But in America, there were some people that came out and just got to America, and I don't know what happened to my husband. So Rav Moshe Feinstein has 10 shuvos back to back in his first five of Igros Moshe Chelik Ibn Ezra dealing with these questions, and perhaps the most stunning of them is the following idea. He says, "B'davar ha'agunos me'ilu shebaleim hayu be'Auschwitz, right? V'chadoma me'hamakom shehargu hanatzim tafshin zayin, right? So we're talking 70 years ago. So b'davar elu shehayu be'Auschwitz v'chadoma me'hamakom shehanatzim yimach shemam sarfum b'kivshoni ha'ish o b'chedrei hagaz v'nitzel mehem rak ma'atim." Right, so they were sent to Auschwitz. They gassed and they burnt, and only a few people survived. Right, gamlo echan mi'elef. Right, 1 in 1,000. Now, that's not clear that that's so accurate. Right, it might have been more than 1 in 1,000. But it also, if you were from Poland, it probably was 1 in 1,000. I mean, the vast majority of I remember once seeing a statistic like this: 80% of the survivors of Auschwitz were Hungarian, 15% were Polish, 5% were Lithuanian. Right. So it depends again on your era. V'gam elu she where are we here? V'miatim gam lo echam mi'elef v'gam elu she yudei rak shenishlchu l'sham echi ishlodu medaver nishoseihem. Right, and all we know is that they were sent to Auschwitz. We don't know anything else. What are we going to do about their wives? And now he puts in, I just want to just highlight this clause, and if you go through these responses, you see this over and over again. It says, right? I want to tell you a chiddush, which I think is right. Right? Right? And if my, friends, If other rebbeim sign onto this, yesh lehatiran michabalei ha'igun shaharbi chashu chazal lezeh v'gam shachas v'shalom lo yechumra da'asu lidei kula. He says, but if my friends sign onto this, I have a leniency that will be able to be matir a lot of people. I mean, I have kind of a magic bullet, right? And they said, A, we need to matir them, and B, he has to throw in something else. Shachas v'shalom lo yedei chumra da'asu lidei kula. Realize if we're too machmir on these people, what are they going to do? They're going to get married anyways, right? So let's figure out a kula here. Let's figure it out. So what is his big kula? And that's the underlined part at the bottom. He says, "Dulai lo siknu lasor ela b'davar." He says he quotes the idea that we said before that really theoretically we should be able to matir all these cases of majority. Right? Rove should be able, we should say Rove, right? We follow the Rove, right? It's only a chumra, it's a gzeira that we don't just follow the majority. And he says, Dulai, lo siknu, perhaps this takana was only less or el bedavasha suffik berov, right? Is only when it's actually a suffik berova pa'amim hu rak al ish echad, va'az afil kishnizdam, shiya suffik al harbe anashim, lo siknu lesser. Sorry, I skipped. Maybe that gezeira is only when we're dealing with one person. One person shows up, I have this shaila, so then we have a gezeira. He says, "Va'az afil kishtami shiya suffik al harbi na'ashim." But if it would be on many people, maybe the gezeira doesn't apply. Right, that is a massive kiddush, right? Gezeira is only if it's on one person. If it's and truth is, he's thinking about this conceptually. What's the case, like that case that Rav Illoway was machmiran, right? This guy who jumped off the boat, from New Orleans to New York, right? What happened? There were survivors, right? That case, there are survivors. This guy didn't survive, so we're posketing on that guy. But when you've destroyed all of Europe, right? So then who says, I even saw someplace that just being in Europe should be enough of a rove, right? The majority of Jews in Europe died. That should be it. That should be enough to be able to be matir them. Some suggested that. Okay, so when I was at the RCA convention 2 weeks ago, so I asked Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz this question. He was a rove actually in Philadelphia, probably during that era. Maybe, no, not a little after that era. He was a rove in
Chicago.
Well, he's in Chicago now. He's been in Chicago. He's been an obvious of Chicago for decades now. Right. But he was in Philadelphia at where the mikveh used to be.
Strawberry Mansion, Logan.
Logan, right. I think he was there. I think he was in Logan. So I asked him, how did this work? Yeah, how does it work? A woman shows up. She comes off a boat that says, "Rabbi, I want to get married. I don't know what happened to my husband." Right? How did it work? He said, she has to go to a beis din. I said, really? Like there wasn't? He said, no. That was like they have to end the Rabbanim Paskin. So I didn't get to continue the conversation with him, but I ended up driving Rav Schachter from the convention back home. So I asked him this, and his father was a Rav during this time, also happened to be in Philadelphia, a little north of Center City. He told me he used to walk to Liberty Bell on Shabbos. So I was like, Lemaisa, how did this work? He said, there are Bati Dinim that were set up to resolve these issues. So, well, like in America, in Israel, he says, there were some in America and Israel, but most of them were in the camps. That there were Bati Dinim that were set up in the camps to resolve this. I said, who? Like Rabbanim went to deal with it? Like the American Rabbanim, Israeli Rabbanim? Said, no, survivors. The survivors set up Bati Dinim in the DP camps, and they resolved these issues. And I said, okay. I just did a little Google search to find out, to maybe see some information about this, some memory, and I came across gold. I came across there is a book that was actually given to me a couple of years ago, if I remember, in Phoenix, who kind of knew the author a little bit. And I wasn't sure if it was for me or for the shul, so I left it in the shul. The name of the book is Hidden in Thunder. It was written by someone named Esther Farbstein, who wrote survivors or survivor herself, but it is a kind of how the Orthodox community dealt with the Holocaust. Shas Maisa at the time, and she has two chapters there on resolving the Aguna issues, and so I couldn't find it. I thought there was a copy in the Kol. I went to the Kol today. I could have sworn I saw a copy of it in the Kol once. I couldn't find it, but Baruch Hashem, it's the year 2015, and Google Books has these couple of chapters. Unfortunately, it only has about three of every four pages. So, but that was enough. That was enough to use the footnotes to come across somebody by the name of Ritzvi Hirsch Meisels. Ritzvi Hirsch Meisels. So she actually introduces the chapter, and she actually has a copy of the letter that was sent by Rav Chaim Leib Orbach. Who was Rav Chaim Leib Orbach? Rav Chaim Leib Orbach was the Av Beis Din of Yerushalayim, or one of the Bati Din in Yerushalayim at least, and the father of somebody that we might recognize, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. So Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach's father, who is the Av Beis, and writes a letter to the Jewish agency who was functioning in 1944 in Europe, as Europe is beginning to be liberated. I mean, the war is not over, but he writes a letter. What is this place, Sobibor? Anybody heard of Sobibor? Oh, yeah, you've heard of it? I never heard of it before. Yeah.
It's the only death camp for escape.
What?
It was an organized escape from the Soviet
Union. Oh, you've heard of it. Okay.
Yeah.
So Rav Orbach writes a letter. What is this place? Was it a work camp? Was it, or was it a death camp? And I don't have the answer that was given to him. And the truth is that there is escape might factor into the question. But that was the shayla that was asked. You could see in this book, it's available, it's on Google Books, you can see a copy of the letter that was sent. And that's how she introduces this chapter of trying to figure out all these things. Now, she writes that there were some communities that took some measures beforehand. In Ludge, they wrote... Gittin al Tanai. They wrote they wrote Gittin beforehand. If I don't show up by this time, you're hereby divorced. There were those that kept lists. There were meticulous, some Rabbanim kept lists of people that were taken away in order for keeping this in mind. And this was an ongoing, people would write down, and she actually has copies of some lists that were taken of names. Of people that were taken away. And there were discussions, and she records that there were discussions, and Rabbanim in camps were having talks about this, and there are tshuvas where Rabbanim wrote, you know, I was on work detail near the crematorium, and I thought of the following idea. Right? This was on the mind of Rabbanim while they are in the camps. And one of the people that were very involved is someone by the name of Ritzvi Hirsch Meisels. Ritzvi Hirsch Meisels was a confidant of the Satmar Rav. The Satmar Rav, of course, got out. He did not get out. He was in the camps. He was in Auschwitz. And was on the death march, I assume, on the death march to Bergen-Belsen. I'm not sure he ended up in Bergen-Belsen after the war. And he set up a base to deal with these issues. Bergen-Belsen was where I think a lot of people were taken. That became kind of a DB camp where a lot of people ended up. And on the back of the page are a few of the tshuvos in Binyan Tzvi. He actually has several different books of tshuvos. This happened to find pretty easily on Hebrew books, so I brought a few examples from these tshuvos. But there is much literature that he wrote during and after. He ended up coming to setting up a yeshiva, actually, in Bergen-Belsen. He set up a yeshiva there while they were being in DP camps, and then he came to America, was sent by the... the Baba Varebi told him to go to Chicago. And in fact, there is some sort of Satmar presence in Chicago because of Zvi Hirsch Meisel's appearance there. So we don't have the time to go through this really inside, but I'll just give you the highlights of these three tshuvas. Number one, that top tshuva, he talks about Treblinka. And he says that Treblinka, even though there was some kind of rebellion in Treblinka that some people escaped also, but Treblinka was a death camp. And there aren't really any survivors, although there were some people that were kept to do work and dig graves and stuff like that. The vast majority of people that were sent to Treblinka, you could assume that they died. So that's what he writes. He considers it a mayim sheyesh lahem sof. If you were on a train to Treblinka, that is considered a mayim sheyesh lahem sof. If we can ascertain that you were there, mutter. That's what he writes. Although again, he kind of... As you see in the last paragraph there, he says, I hope some people like my tshuva, and if people like my tshuva, then they'll matir this person, right? It's kind of like this hedging bets kind of thing, but he's willing to be matir based on that. I will also point out that this is section chaf of this tshuva, right? Okay? And I would also point out the way he signs it. Look at the way he signs it, right? He kuf. I don't understand hakadosh, because that's a real weird to say that about yourself, but Tzvi Hirsch Meislish, Av based in Kadosh Bergen-Belsen. Right? Wow. Okay, so that was that is issue number one in source number eight. Source number nine. He writes to, you can see the name on top, to Rav Yecheskel Abramsky, right? He writes this from Bergen-Belsen to Rav Yecheskel Abramsky. I'm actually distantly related to him. The Beis Din in London, the head of the Beis Din in London. And what is he writing about here? Yeah, he says, trust me. See that paragraph, the second paragraph begins by saying, Yaminli, trust me, right? He's kind of, Abramsky apparently wrote to him, telling him, you should tell them to wait a little bit, because news is getting out, you know, liberation takes time, and word's getting around, and there were lists there put up all over the place, everybody's walking around trying to find relatives, and you should tell them to wait. And he responds to Abramsky telling him, yeah, I've also told people to wait, but you can't tell them to wait forever. And they're telling me, v'tainasam, look, four lines from the bottom, v'tainasam b'fihem, three lines from the bottom, kimaya od ezed ninud safik b'libam shinsoseyem im yaldeyem odem chayim, if they had any doubt that their wife and their children were still alive, loya rotsun linasa, they wouldn't want to remarry mishacher, so somebody else, bi'ad kol chalal d'alma, right, with somebody else, with somebody in the world. Af b'li chashasha iser, rak ach, even if they weren't concerned about the prohibition. Rak acharei sheledavon livavam hanishbar hadavar bar etzlam. But because of the broken heart, it's clear to them that the relatives are no longer. And you can't just keep them held hostage like this. At some point, you have to pass in the shayla. That's what he writes to Rav Abramsky. There is Mrs. Rebitz and Sharfstein in the book points out that there was a tug of, there was kind of a machlokas between the between Rabbanim paskening in the camps. There's a Rabbanim paskening outside the camps.
Well, this is evidence.
This is evidence of it.
Yeah.
But she points out the chakira was, and it also had to do with ghettos, outside the camp, they figured that, yeah, if you're in a ghetto, so there are people that got out of ghettos. So, okay. So, well, you know, a ghetto isn't necessarily sure that you're in, that it was over. It wasn't, and they add in, and there's some technical ideas of an army that is looking to conquer versus an army that is looking to destroy. They said it could be that the ghettos in the beginning, if you got a way out, you had a way out. They weren't necessarily trying to kill everybody. It was only later on they decided to kill everybody, while the people in the camps and that were in the ghettos said, no, they were trying to kill us the entire time. There's no, it's considered imaim she'in lahem sof, she'ish lahem sof the entire time. And then number 10, he what was this issue? He actually has an idea. So Rav Schechter, when I was in the car with Rav Schechter commented to me that somebody had an idea that they should just write a heter klali. That anybody, any woman who got out of a camp who husband wasn't, assuming they know that the husband was in a camp, they should be mutter. And he said that was rejected. Meaning somebody had this idea to write heter klali. So that's surprising to me. I didn't see anybody else make a comment about that. Could be what he was referring to, or maybe this is just something else, that Tzvi Hirsch College suggests that there should be a heter meir rabbanim klali. Meaning the other way around. We can't necessarily help the women, maybe we can help the men. Right? And he says we should write a heter meir rabbanim klali, that any man who has evidence that somebody told him that his wife went left instead of right when they got to Auschwitz, they should just be mutter. They shouldn't be required to even come to a Beis Din. Right? That's the suggestion that he had. He says no. I mean, at the end, it's not accepted. But that is his suggestion of this for Tzvi Hirsch Kalish. There are other people that were involved as well at the end of this. Sharfshi has an afterword, a story about Rav Yaakov Avigdor, who apparently was on a Beis Din, and a woman from his town comes in front of him, and the woman doesn't recognize him, and he asks, like, and she says, I want to get remarried, and he says, I can't, you know, do you have any evidence? He says, no, I don't have any. You know what? There was this fellow who was from my town who gave me I was walking around in Italy. I end up in Italy, and he tells me, you know, I saw your husband, and he died. And he said, and you should know that, and here's a letter with my name, and you should keep this letter. And she said, I don't need this letter, I want it, whatever. And then she said, a couple of years later, what was I going to rebuild at that point? I didn't think about it, it wasn't an issue. And now it's a few months later, and I want to move on a little bit. And Baruch Hashem, he gave me that letter. And he pulled out the letter, and it was his son. That was this Rav Yaakov Avigdor. That's how he found out that his son was alive. That this girl produced a letter that this guy kind of stuck in her pocket, saying, you might want to hold on to this and keep it one day. It might come in handy one day. I'm sorry, we're rushing here at the end, but I would just point to the bottom left. The bottom left is a Ksav Heter that this Mrs. Sharfstein has in her book. Right, that's I can't make out the handwriting. I can't even tell what the stamp says. But this was what they wrote. You know, they would write to a woman, they'd give her this letter, and that's how she would be able to hopefully go forward and rebuild. So I don't, I there's a lot more to say. In fact, before I came across this book, I figured the last couple of last 15 minutes I would spend on cases that they got wrong. And there are some cases out there where they got wrong, and how that was how that could possibly
husband shows up.
Right? There's stories of like two grandchildren, like two people were getting married, and the two and the grandfather and the grandmother all of a sudden realized that they were married to each other once upon a time.
It's on the internet.
That story.
It's circulating around today. I saw it. The grandmother had a half fork. She gave the bride, her granddaughter, and the groom comes in, and he's got the other half of the
fork. Gosh.
And his father comes in, and they were
married. It's today, okay. So this is going back, and there are issues. There's a couple of famous stories about Rav Moshe Feinstein about this. Not that he ever got it wrong, but that's a question that is that is out there. Maybe we'll find another opportunity about that in the future. Yes.
Does the rabbis keep track?